This episode is sponsored by Canaccord Genuity Wealth Management, experienced wealth managers who go above and beyond to guide and support you. Can-do is more than just an attitude. It's navigating today for a brighter tomorrow. Visit candowealth.com.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm Lucy Dunn, the diary reporter at The Spectator, and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Seal. Today we're going to be discussing the fallout from yesterday's budget. Katie, first of all, I'll turn to you. What is the general reaction to the UK budget and what's the fallout that we've seen so far?
I think it's pretty mixed, but it's also quite muted in the sense that I don't think there's much excitement, nor is there that much anger really on all sides. I mean, they've got some, I think if you look at the front pages, for example, just to get a sense of where the papers are leaning, it's all fairly predictable. The Guardian suggesting it's desperate, effectively the Telegraph focusing on something I don't think Jeremy Hunt quite delivered in the chamber, which was this suggestion that having taken 4p in total of national insurance, if you combine the budget with the autumn statement, he would eventually like to get rid of national insurance entirely. It was more a point that he hinted at but came clear after the address, and the Telegraph has led with that as, you know, potentially a future. And now you have a situation where Labour is doing, I would say snazzy, but I don't think it's that snazzy, a graphic merging Rishi Sunak's face or Liz Truss's face to suggest that, you know, this is 40 something billion of unfunded tax cuts. I don't think it really works. I think the fact that you have figures from the Resolution Foundation also pointing out it doesn't really work as an attack line, which is, you know, it's one thing to have an unfunded tax cut, is another to talk about an ambition. But you can start to see, you know, where they want to go on it. So I think that's how it's kind of shaken out to a degree. I think when it comes to MPs, there are plenty who don't really think it's a game-changer budget. I don't think number 10 think it's a game-changer budget. I think it is almost seen as a stable, fairly cautious. I say cautious despite the fact Jeremy Hunt has not left him much space at all in terms of headroom, but I think in terms of Tory expectations, a fairly cautious budget. And it, I think, is just adding to the sense amongst MPs that they don't think this is the budget you do straight before announcing a May election. But it is still one that I think is laying some traps for Labour politically.
Yeah, and James, I suppose on that note about Labour, there's been a number of comments made about how the Tories have stolen some of Labour's ideas when it comes to abolishing the non-dom tax and extending the windfall tax in oil and gas in Scotland. What are your thoughts on that? Are Labour being pinned into a bit of a difficult corner themselves as a result?
Yeah, that's certainly the main aim. And we've talked before on this podcast about how often, when the Labour Party have tax plans, they simply go along with the Conservatives, such as the mini-budget, which 90% of which Labour went along with, apart from the 45p tax cut. And now the Conservatives are doing similar, really, which is that, you know, populist revenue raiser measures means that it's going to cause Labour to rethink their own spending plans. And Wes Streeting, the night before the budget, admitted that on Sky when he was asked about it. So really, it's just in difficult times, what are the kind of popular ways you do it? And Katie's written in this week's magazine about the various reasons why they would choose to do non-doms, as well as being politically popular, also sort of tries to shoot Labour's fox on trying to make the issue of Rishi Sunak's wife into a sort of election issue and trying to rebut claims it's sort of being out of touch, etc. And then in terms of the Scottish dimension as well, I mean, I understand last night I did a blog on the 1922 committee Hunt was at, and I think, as Katie was saying there, I think most Tory MPs, it's, you know, they don't object to the budget, but they're not particularly enthusiastic about the budget. And I think low turnout, less than 10% of the party at that 22 meeting, only 3 seconds of ritual disbanding perhaps shows where minds are at. But at that meeting, David de Goude, who's a prominent Scottish Tory MP, did raise the issue of the extension of the North Sea oil levy. So I think that's going to be a concern in the coming days. Obviously, Andrew Bowie's gone public with some of the criticisms, quite a prominent Scottish Tory and a minister in the government. So there's been some talk about him, being potentially on someone to watch for Risk Nation, etc. But that seemed to have fizzled out this afternoon. So really, I think it's a matter of, a budget that perhaps didn't contain too many bunnies, but also not many bombs either. And after the mini budget of 18 months ago, which brought Rishi Sunak indirectly to power, perhaps that's no bad thing.
I think on Andrew Bowie, though, it is, we can talk about resignation watch. What about being sacked watch? Effectively, it's not that normal within the hour after you've delivered a budget for a government minister to come out against it. Now, you can see the reasons for that. Andrew Bowie has a North East seat in Scotland. The extension of the windfall tax, and something, Lucy, you've written about this, is, I think there is a feeling amongst these Scottish MPs that they are ultimately having to pay the price and risking their own seats to provide something for MPs in England. And that is why Andrew Berry has spoken up. The fact that there is no discipline for him is something which, wherever you sit on what he said, will upset his colleagues, because you can't have a situation in terms of cabinet responsibility, and yes, he is not full cabinet, you know, government collective responsibility, whereby you're allowed to just say, oh, I don't actually like that policy. It encourages everyone else to do a similar thing.
And the irony is, in, I think, in recent months, very few Tories have been optimistic, but the only optimistic Tories you like to find are the Scottish Conservatives, who hope to kind of exploit some of the difficulties that Humza Yousaf and the SNP have had up in Scotland. And I think if you look at some of the polling, the bit of the country, the sort of the whole UK, where the Tories hold best in their terms of keeping their seats is likely to be north of the border.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite interesting that I suppose the fortunes for the Tory party generally haven't looked great over the past year, you know, putting it mildly. But in Scotland, certainly the Tories and Douglas Ross even said to the Spectator at the Tory party conference in October that he was expecting a really good general election for them. And, you know, polling is showing that they've got seven seats just now. And certainly the issue of oil and gas in Scotland and the North Sea is a big battleground just now for the Scottish Tories, given that the SNP and Labour don't really have, they've not been particularly decisive on that issue. They don't really know where they stand. Scottish Labour hasn't appealed very well to the rural population, something that the Tories in Scotland are good at. And I suppose this is sort of the root of the frustration from, you know, Andrew Bowie, also Douglas Ross as well, the leader of the Scottish Tories, didn't look very happy in the Commons yesterday and again put out a statement similar to Andrew Bowie's. I've noticed that Andrew has, in the last couple of hours after his first statement yesterday, seemed to sort of pull things back a little bit, and sort of the message that he was putting across was that only the Conservatives support oil and gas industry, and that ultimately the Tories just need to get on with delivering what they've put out in the budget. But certainly there are cracks there, and I suppose both Jeremy Hunt and Rishi Sunak are going to be quite likely to ensure they don't widen over the next couple of months.
Yeah, I think it was an awkward moment this morning when you had Jeremy Hunt on the media and he was asking, well, who are the losers from your budget? And he said non-doms and Scottish oil and gas industry. And you didn't think, well, that's quite a helpful soundbite, regardless of the SNP and Scottish Labour themselves have to say on it.
And this is why I think the Michelle Donnellan row, which has been going on right now about her using government money to pay off the damages from a case, is a little bit damaging, because obviously north of the border, the Scottish Tory theirs have been making great hay out of the fact that Michael Matheson ran up a phone bill. How many thousands was it, Lucy?
It's £11,000.
£11,000 on taxpayers' expense, and that's been leading the charge on that. And now, of course, they've got the Michelle Donnellan case, which is suboptimal, I'd say.
Absolutely. Going back to the budget, it's been presented as a tax-cutting budget, but I suppose there has been sort of a real mixed reaction about that, as Katie was saying earlier. And you know, the talk about when this general election will be, people are saying that ultimately this doesn't seem to be the pre-election budget set out by the Conservatives. Katie, do you think that there could be a second fiscal event later in the year? Are we sort of going to expect more radical tax cuts? Maybe something that the Trussites in the party might want to see?
I think the problem is there just isn't that much headroom, and Jeremy Hunt cut it pretty fine in what he did. Is it feasible that you're going to have a situation where that drastically changes before an election? And if it is, are you going to have enough time to announce a tax cut and then have that felt by voters? You know, you're going to have this national insurance cut come through in April. When do we think the election would be if it's a bit later in the year, which I still think is the most likely scenario at the moment? I think there are reasons due to the US election clash, but also various other potential black swans that the Tories might be a bit sceptical now of a November vote. So maybe it's October, in which case, is there really the timings to fit it in? Of course, if inflation falls, as was suggested yesterday, to 2% in the next couple of months, and then you get rate cuts, then perhaps that is the kind of thing. But would the Tories be better focusing that in a budget or in a manifesto? And I think what you can bet on is the fact that the Tories have found that where they want to attack. So going back to the Labour financing point and what this budget does, I don't think this budget is a game changer in terms of the election, but I do think it's still possible to say this will not transform Tory fortunes, and at the same time say it makes life a little bit uncomfortable for Labour, because you have Rachel Reeves not able to say how she's now going to fund the various things she funded with the non-dom money, and they will have to come back and do that. You had one shadow minister not ruling out the idea of tax rises. Labour will be loath to announce tax rises for working people ahead of an election, but the questions are now on them. And what the Tories are trying to do is to get into a place where the dividing line is when they have spare money and they have headroom, they cut taxes, whereas what do you think Labour are going to do? And if if they can make Labour trip up, as they did with the 28 billion, or go back on their plans and not be able to answer questions, then that the argument which they're trying to prosecute, which is Labour has no plan, leaving aside whatever the Tories' plan is going to become easier to do.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you, James. And thank you for listening.